You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War. This episode is the first interview for the podcast, but certainly not the last. Last week, I released the War Spites special, and when I did all the normal social media stuff. When I posted on Twitter, Ian Ballantyne was tagged by one of my listeners. And for every series of episodes for the podcast or special episode, there is a foundational source. Sometimes it's the book I read first, sometimes it's the book I found to be the most useful, but there's always something that functions as kind of a baseline for all of my other research. For the War Spite special, that book was Mr. Ballantyne's War Spite. After a bit of back and forth on Twitter, we ended up arranging an interview that was done just this past Wednesday, and I wanted to get it out as soon as possible. I hope you enjoy our conversation. We discussed a few pieces of the podcast and some of the research that Mr. Ballantyne did for his book. If you would like to check out any of Mr. Ballantyne's books, you can find a link in the show notes or on the website at historyofthesecondworldwar.com/interviews. You can look forward to more interviews starting on Sunday, December 13th, at which point the Spanish Civil War interview series will begin. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special History of the Second World War interview. Today, I'm joined by Ian Ballantyne, a fantastic author, and most importantly for our purposes, the author of War Spite, an absolutely critical source in the creation of the War Spite special that was released last week. Mr. Ballantyne, how's it going today?
It's going well. I've been working away in my bunker, and it's been typical Plymouth weather, which means rain, but hopefully we'll get some sunshine. As you know, people in Britain like to talk a lot about the weather, and that's because there's a lot of it. As there is over there, of course.
I've been to Britain twice, and it has rained almost the entire time I've been there, both times.
Yeah, well, when it's really magnificent weather here, it's really fantastic, because then you go down to Plymouth Hoe and you can see out into the Sound, where you'll see warships of today. And the Sound is one of the most magnificent harbours in the world, and obviously a place where War Spite was seen many times, having been built here in Plymouth at Devonport Dockyard.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So your book, War Spite, is about the whole history of the ship. And if we look at some of the British battleships that were present at one of its most famous battles at Jutland, there are names that kind of evoke heroism: Conqueror, Centurion, Thunderer, Valiant, Revenge. There are names that reference great victories like Agincourt, St. Vincent. There are names that reference heroic mythical Greek heroes: Ajax, Orion, Bellerophon. Which brings me to my first question. What is a war spite?
War spite is a name that embodies British defiance and bloody-mindedness in the face of the enemy, basically. And that's a characteristic of English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh people in general. But in terms of war spite, the warship, then it's said that it's meant to embody contempt for the enemy, which would have been an expression of England's feelings towards Spain at the time of the first war spite, which was in the late 16th century. And also, there's also a reference to spite, meaning woodpecker. So the idea was that the war spite would peck at enemies' ship's hulls with her guns. And I must admit, a curious thing happened, if I can just digress for a second, when I was researching and writing Warspite in 1999. I lived in a place called Hemel Hempstead, which is up near London. And our garden used to be part of an orchard, and there were lots of trees, apple trees, in the garden. And as I was beginning the book, it was really weird because I heard the knock, knock, knock of a woodpecker. And so I looked out into the garden, and this is kind of strange, but it was a traditional European green woodpecker with the red head. And that was actually the unofficial badge of HMS Warspite, obviously to do with the spite, i.e. the woodpecker, symbol or meaning to the name. And so that was kind of freaky at the time I was starting the book, but it's a true story. I did see a woodpecker.
I guess that's really interesting how a name like that can have meanings that kind of get lost as technology advances. Obviously, it made a lot of sense back when ships were made of wood, but maybe not so much later on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was one ship was called Thunderer, which was, I suppose, a great name for a wooden wall line of battleship doing a broadside. And I guess translated to the battleship Thunderer as well. And in the days that followed, in fact, the years that followed, Thunderer became the name of a shore establishment, because we have things called stone frigates in the UK, which are old warship names used for shore bases. And Thunderer was a naval engineering college actually here in Plymouth. So today you have HMS Nelson, which is the Portsmouth barracks and naval base. And that was, of course, a battleship of World War II. So the names still carry on.
Interesting. I did not know that about the sort of the shore establishments taking on ship names.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And HMS Drake is the one here in Devonport. And then you used to have one up in Rosyth in Scotland called HMS Cochrane. But that Cochrane was named after a famous warrior of the Age of Sail. So that was why that name was picked, because he was also Scottish. So that made sense. So there's a variety of reasons why British warship names get historic meaning and also attached to people. And if you look at Jutland, you've got Valiant with Warspite in the 5th Battle Squadron, and also, of course, Barham was a first Sea Lord. Valiant is a name that embodies courage and tenacity. And then, of course, you also had Malaya, which was a ship named after part of the British Empire, which had been partly funded by the people of Malaya. So there's all sorts of things involved in these ship names in the Royal Navy.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, really, around where they're coming from. When we look at the time that the Warspite was laid down, the pace of British naval construction before the First World War is, I think, unbelievable. You know, they're laying down multiple ships, multiple capital ships every year, entire classes. I think six is the most they sort of create in 1 year. So do we have any sense of what kind of the expected lifespan was of something like the Warspite was in those years?
I suppose it depends on circumstances, how well built a warship was and what its fighting power was. Because if you look at the battle cruiser Tiger, which was laid down in 1912 and completed in 1914, a battle cruiser, light-skinned but capital-sized shaped and heavily armed. But as you said in your original podcast, the temptation was that a big ship with big guns would be used alongside tougher, more robust battleships, but would actually have only the armour of a very fast, huge cruiser. So Lion became obsolete during the war, and so she was completed in 1914, but then sent to the breakers yard after a bit of peace following the First World War 18 years later, whereas Warspite went on to serve for 30 years. But then there were other battleships which more rapidly became out of fashion and obsolete, and including Orion, which was completed in 1912, but by 1922 had been sent to the breakers, because I guess, unlike Warspite, Orion was coal-powered. She didn't have 15-inch guns. She wasn't as robust, perhaps, in her construction. So Orion was discarded. And the Royal Navy is notorious, as a remark in my book at the end of the Warspite story, for being unsentimental. So there's no hanging on to warships that really are not going to be any good. Some do survive, and some did see action in World War II that shouldn't have, such as the Hood, perhaps, or the Renown and the Repulse. And they were battle cruisers that were remodeled some extensively. And in the end, they weren't tough enough to go up against ships like the Bismarck. So the Royal Navy will keep a ship and look at a ship and say, what can we use this ship for? What use has it got? Gun power, protection, relative speed. And can we use it to hold the line against anybody? And in the Queen Elizabeth class, including Warspite, they were seen, as you said yourself, to be amazing products of foresight, of naval architecture and actually construction. So hence she served on so long. But she was due to go out of service, but the Second World War, out of necessity, until the new King George V class battleships came in, kept Warspite in the front line. And as you said in your podcast, and I actually, of course, cover in my book, there was a radical rebuild, which meant that Warspite could conceivably fight other more modern ships.
So you talk about that major refit in the mid-1930s.
Yeah.
So it's still, an older ship. So yeah. What were the kind of expectations for Warspite sort of as the Second World War began? How did the Admiralty think it compared to other ships that were out there?
I think the Admiralty realized that this was a stopgap, which is why that was, in reality, more than just a refit. That was a rebuild, a major reconstruction. As you know, she had her guns improved with elevation, so she could shoot further, could lob a shell so much further than she could before. Her machinery was modernized as much as possible. And also the command and control tower was made into this hulking, great, big, ugly tower of a thing, which was gas-proof.
They really are very ugly. Like,
yeah. But the thing they remind me of, and HMS Rodney and HMS Nelson are the same, is like knights. So the hull is the horse, and this great big helmet of a tower is where the brain is. And so they were, they were brutish looking and ugly, but I think they were designed to do the job. And I don't think the Admiralty, by the time 1937 came along, 1938 came along, was under any illusions that it was falling behind and had to get on with using Warspite. And Queen Elizabeth and Valiant, the two sisters that were modernised and rebuilt, to hold the line. Because Britain had, typically British actually, had foolishly adhered to the arms treaties, whereas other people, the Germans, the Japanese, the Italians, were clearly breaking the conditions, were pressing on with larger ships with bigger caliber of guns. So they had a lot of catching up to do, and I guess kept their fingers crossed. Warspite and her sisters, and Rodney and Nelson, which were the two most modern ships in the Royal Navy in September 1939, at somewhat, 16 years old, would be able to hang on until these new battleships came into service. So necessity is why Warspite was still there, I guess.
And so during the war, you mentioned several times in your book about living conditions aboard ship, especially sort of when the ship goes out of the North Sea, Northern Atlantic area, specifically like to Eastern Africa, where it would spend some time.
Yeah.
So what were living conditions like aboard a capital ship like this during the Second World War? How did it try to adjust to different climates? I get the impression that something like air conditioning is not available.
That's a huge contrast, of course, to the US Navy's submarines and warships in the Second World War. And the problem was that, of course, the Royal Navy built its submarines and, in fact, all its warships for more temperate climates like the North Sea, the Atlantic, and the Mediterranean. Could just about handle the Mediterranean. But bizarrely, despite the Royal Navy being tasked with patrolling the entire world, with its cruisers, for example, and battleships sometimes, to safeguard the empire as it was then, air conditioning, proper air conditioning and conditions were not there. And so they had to sleep on deck. They had to strip down to the bare minimum of clothing, even in the Mediterranean, where there's a memorable piece in the book where a destroyer comes alongside HMS Warspite expected to see the battleship, the Mediterranean fleet flagship, with everybody in smart uniforms, what they call pussers, as in strict disciplined uniforms and wearing proper gear. And they find the crew of the flagship in this battleship are dressed in shorts, you know, and vests, and they're scruffy looking, like the desert rats would be ashore. So it was quite a surprise to some people to see that battleship sailors, these amazing queens of the sea, would have these sort of ragamuffin crews. But that was out of necessity. And I think one of the people you highlighted was a Royal Marine I met called Ken Smith. And in the Indian Ocean, he told me that they suffered terrible conditions. And if I look at the book, he said that they were intolerable and that they had extreme temperatures. And of course, they'd be closed up at action stations, in his case, on the 6-inch secondary guns for hours at a time. And these were like sweat boxes, and there were hundreds of people going sick. And he got a thing, and other people got a thing called the Dobie itch. They got prickly heat. And they had to keep buckets of water near them to douse themselves. And he actually became quite ill with the conditions. So it wasn't good. And it was something that bedeviled the Royal Navy's warships in the tropics throughout World War II.
Yeah, and I guess if you become sort of ill in that situation, there's not a whole lot that can be done. You know, you're on a ship.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, there's the ship's doctor, and obviously each battleship would have a medical team that would try and look after people. But when you've got a crew, ship's company of 1,000 Royal Marines, sailors, and people who are on a staff, an admiral staff, then it's going to be pretty crowded in there. So there's a limit to what they can do. So, of course, they had to go to Durban in South Africa, or go to Trincomalee in what was then Ceylon to get a rest. And East Africa, as you said, I think it's called Kilindini, where they would park their battleships for a break. So, yeah, it was pretty arduous stuff. And people don't often think about that when they think about battleships and warships in the Second World War, because that would have a real impact on fighting capability.
So you mentioned that. You mentioned things that people don't think about. So one of the things that I didn't really think about, I think I've probably read more than the average person about naval warfare, yeah, is how, like, the entire crew would sometimes rotate out of these ships. I think you mentioned in your book, like, several times throughout the war, sort of the entire crew rotates off the warspite. So, you know, when it comes into, America for its fixing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then when it leaves, it's maybe a totally different set of people.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't actually, for the Royal Navy, I'm sure it'd be the same in other navies, that wasn't unusual. But then what they would do is they would switch out half the ship's company. So let's say you have 1,000 guys. In peacetime, for example, another ship I wrote about, HMS Rodney, there's a bit in that book where it discusses, or one of the guys that talked to mentions that 500 of them walked through the barracks gates in Devonport, the naval base in Plymouth, down through the dockyard to Rodney, which has already discharged 500 sailors to go back home to live with their families in Plymouth or further afield in Wales or wherever, London. And so they need a new draft of 500 people to join the core crew that's left on board. And of course, sailors in peacetime would go away in these battleships of the Royal Navy for 2 to 3 years. And if they were at Malta, they'd take their families with them. If they went further afield, they wouldn't. So the idea was that if, let's say, Rodney, which didn't really go overseas that much in peacetime, would come in and then change over the crew so people could get a rest ashore and get trained. Well, Warspite was in the Mediterranean in peacetime, and so she would come home with all her crew and then switch out when they got home. And I think the incident you're talking about is when, definitely that you're talking about, because you mentioned it, is that Warspite was damaged at the Battle of Crete. She went to Puget Sound to get repaired on the west coast of the USA. And they took 500 guys off, sent them home, and 500 Royal Marines, because they helped cruise ships in those days, and sailors were sent on this amazing journey from Halifax, after taking going with a convoy across the Atlantic, dodging the U-boats, that then got on a train, I think, in Halifax. And at the time, America was still neutral, so they had to pass through America when it was still neutral for a short moment. I'm trying to recall the details. And then they went across Canada So they had these stops in Calgary and places like that, and some of them went missing and they went off drinking, and they had to go and round them up. So 500 young men, you know, who were looking for, you know, adventures, were taken across North America in these trains. And then, as you say, they were then put on board the Warspite, which had been already blooded with 500 people that had been to war. And here were these new guys coming in, and they were going to be expected to take that ship back out. Yeah.
They got the safest adventure of the war after Absolutely. They got to Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, they tried to make it as unsafe as they could, but they were rounded up. So that was that's a brilliant episode. Yeah, great.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
You've mentioned several times already, and there's a lot of it in your book. So you have a lot of these firsthand accounts from sailors. How did you get these accounts? Were you talking with veterans in later years who had sort of lived these experiences?
I was a journalist, a reporter on various newspapers. And in 1990, I came down to I worked in the London area and around other parts of the UK, but 1990, it came down to Plymouth, which has a huge tradition as a naval base and dockyard and port, because it's got this massive dockyard and naval base called Devonport. And so when I arrived there, I'd just done a trip on the USS Dwight Eisenhower, which was an aircraft carrier, which was in the Mediterranean, which was a very thrilling experience to fly on board. And so I was interested in military history and navies, but I hadn't really got into the Navy in terms of writing and reporting. So I thought when I came down to Plymouth, and there were a lot of warships here back in the early 90s, I thought it's quite the Navy was quite interesting. And so I was a defense reporter. I became the defense reporter on my evening newspaper. And I was, as part of my job, I would cover the World War II anniversaries of the battles in the Med and various other things. And it was at the time of the 50th anniversary of the Second World War. And so I did a series of features where I would go around Plymouth, and there were hundreds, if not thousands, of war veterans alive at that time. And I would go and meet people either living in Plymouth or who came back to pay their respects at this massive naval war memorial we've got here to their lost comrades. So I would kind of go to their meetings, their reunions in pubs and military service clubs. And so I'd started to do that then. But when it came to Warspite, I'd left the Evening Herald, as it was called, in Plymouth, and I was working in London. And then I went freelance, and I decided I'd like to write naval history books. And this was the late 90s. And I thought, well, the one I've got to do is Warspite, the most famous, the one with the most battle honours, and an amazing ship, you know, 2 world wars. So I put an advert in the British Legion magazine, which is for, you know, the ex-servicemen's association for all military people, a bit like the American Legion or any other legion in the military in any country. And then I also put adverts in newspapers and got to know some of the people from the Warspite, and I was invited to what was their 14th reunion in Weymouth. And there were dozens of them there, and it was a big event in a hotel, and it was a whole weekend. And the strange thing about war veterans, if we just digress a second, is that most of them, when they finished the war, and for 20 or 30 years or more, didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to discuss it. And they didn't start thinking about setting up associations to meet their shipmates again until often the 1980s. And that was the case with the Warspite. So this was their 14th reunion in 1999. And so their 14th since 1985, which is quite astonishing when you think that the war finished in 1945. So it was, I was just in time, you know, in a 10-year period of my working and starting to write naval history books to meet these incredible men in not only the Warspite and HMS Rodney and smaller warships and other warships across the 90s. And so I did talk to them, and then I would see them at reunions, take a few notes, meet them on the sidelines from maybe not during the dinner, but the following day. I'd go and sit at a table with them, and then they would have a service of remembrance on the seafront. And then afterwards, I would sort of chat with them and get their phone numbers and go and see them and talk to them on the phone. So it was an incredible period of meeting the Warspite veterans and others. And obviously, I've got training as a journalist, so I can take shorthand notes. And they would lend me, they would lend me things like the Warspite Association magazine, which was an amazing fund of what the Royal Navy calls DITs, which is stories about naval life. And then I would go to the Imperial War Museum as well and listen to their sound archive stuff. So there was quite an amazing period of working when I could combine talking to veterans with what is now left in the archives. So it was amazing.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. It's kind of being at the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And I wish I'd started 10 years earlier, to be honest. But
yeah. There you go. Yeah, that's how it always is, I guess.
Yeah.
Especially with things like this. So after the Second World War, British not constructing any more battleships, because that's how it goes. But the Warspite name would be resurrected as part of the Valiant class submarines. Do you know if there were discussions that occurred around resurrecting the Warspite name or these other battleship names, kind of transitioning the battleship name into these nuclear submarines?
I'll be honest, I don't have any insider information about how they kicked around this name. But, I mean, there was a ship's naming committee, still is in some form, which will discuss the ramifications of naming a warship after a particular person, particular part of the country, or some other historic name. So it had to be top of the list that when the Royal Navy was building its first undersea battleships, which is hunter, killer, or fleet submarines, what you call in the American Navy attack submarines, nuclear-powered attack submarines, in the early 1960s, that they would look at battleship names, because these were the new capital ships of the Cold War Navy. So Warspite had such an amazing record, such a lucky ship, despite her many, many accidents and other episodes where she had things go wrong. So there was kind of a feeling that she was a lucky ship, a famous ship, a ship with an amazing fighting record, and a capital ship. So the third nuclear-powered fleet submarine, an SSN, as they're called as well, was Warspite. The first two were Dreadnought, which was a one-off, the first ever nuclear-powered hunter-killer submarine in the Royal Navy. And then Valiant was the second, and Warspite was the third. And then you've got other names after that were equally famous.
And I think I read that the Warspite is possibly the name of a future submarine as well.
Yeah, definitely. If it ever happens, yeah. It's the Royal Navy does an unusual thing these days, which is to name warships many years before they're actually even taking shape, being built at all. So one of the things that they did about 10 years ago, because I now run a naval magazine. Warships IFR magazine, and I have interviewed quite a few First Sea Lords and people like that. And one First Sea Lord, Alan West, about 13, 14 years ago, when I was interviewing him in London, said that they decided to name the first of the new strike carriers, Queen Elizabeth, and the second Prince of Wales, two very famous battleship names as well, particularly Prince of Wales, Queen Elizabeth also, Queen Elizabeth being a sister of Warspite. And that was, you know, just as the thing was getting started. So, okay, we're going to name these ships Queen Elizabeth. I'm going to call the Prince of Wales, and nobody's going to cancel these ships because who's going to upset the Queen or the Prince of Wales? So they've carried on doing that with our new frigates, which are called the City Class. So they've all been named after various places like Glasgow and I think Belfast and also others. Manchester, I think, is one of them as well. And that's years, I mean, many years ahead of the first one is building now, Glasgow. And so when they came up with the new ballistic missile submarines, the version of the Ohio class, your Trident submarines, to replace our Trident submarines in the 2030s, and you know, we're talking quite late into the 2030s, they came up with the Dreadnought class. And we thought, wow, that's fantastic. And Warspite is one of those. And that's fun, you know, brilliant news. But really, by the time that submarine comes in the water, none of us will probably be, we'll all be very old or we'll be dead. So
a lot of wishful thinking.
I mean, could happen, might well happen. Who knows? You know, I don't think you should count your chickens or your warships before they're hatched. But well, that is the plan.
Last 3 weeks of 2020 before we can think about any of that. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, nobody can think about anything. I mean, it's, you know, so we'll see what happens with the new Warspite. But it'd be great if that happens. I mean, you can argue about whether or not Britain or any other nation should still have nuclear weapons, but you know, the name itself has been given to this submarine. So in terms of the name living on, I guess that's it. And of course the job of the new Warspite, if the new Warspite ever happens, will be very sedate, because the whole point of a ballistic missile submarine is to stay out of the way and stay hidden and not do anything through its entire life.
Because say, like, what you want from a nuclear powered submarine as compared to a battleship is you want it to never do anything.
Yeah, never be seen. I mean, I wrote about Warspite, the attack submarine, in another book. I'm plugging another book here, Hunter Killers, which is, tells the story of, I mean, I can't get away from Warspite. But certainly the new Warspite will hopefully never be seen and never do anything at all in anger.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you mentioned sort of the things built up around the Warspite legacy, and I know that you're involved in the Warspite Association. So can you discuss a little bit about the association and sort of its goals?
Yeah, I mean, it's, as I said just a few moments ago, the association is was the Battleship Sailors, and it's a very strong association, and actually it kept going longer than others. You know, other associations disbanded in the late 90s or the very early 2000s. So the Warspite Association with Battleship Sailors, because that's what it's mainly about. There have been other ships called Warspite, and of course the submarine, but it was mainly about the battleship. That was very strong, I'd say, until, I don't know, middle of the first decade of this century, the first 2000s. But as time marches on, sadly, you know, the veterans of World War II have crossed the bar. So it's now mainly submariners and a lot more low-key, but it does have still, the official Warspite Association does have two meetings still. One is in Weymouth, which I think is picked because it's halfway between Portsmouth and Plymouth, two great rival naval cities. And I'm not sure why they did that. Because Warspite was built in Devonport, became a Portsmouth ship. And I suppose there's a bit of kind of confusion about that. And quite a few of her sailors lived near Plymouth and others lived near Portsmouth. So they meet in Weymouth, or they did meet in Weymouth. They still do on a smaller scale. For an annual thing where they pay their respects at the War Memorial on the Sunday. But then the big one, in terms of remembering the end of Warspite's life and part of her legacy, is again, you know, fairly informal, but involves local people as well as associate members of the association like me and the descendants of people that were in the battleship and the submariners, is down at Marazion, which is a small town in Cornwall, near to St. Michael's Mount. But St. Michael's Mount is like Mont Saint-Michel in France. And it's this amazing building, this amazing historic building on top of a kind of a mini mountain in Mounts Bay, which is this amazing bay that runs around the Penzance in Cornwall. And Marazion is the town ashore, as it were, from St. Michael's Mount. And the reason, I'm getting very convoluted here, but the reason they have an annual meeting at Marazion is because, as you noted in your earlier podcast, Warspite, on the way to the breakers, broke free of the tugs, ran aground at a place called Pressure Cove, was stayed there for a while, but was then towed round to the beach at St. Michael's Mount, where she was broken up under over a period of a number of years, and the bits carted away for melting down and turning into razor blades. So that is actually the last resting place of Warspite, and there's still bits of her boilers in the sand there, and there are bits of her wooden panelling from the wardroom and all sorts of bits in the local community, decorating pubs and things. So Marazine is this place that people go in a pilgrimage in the autumn to salute Warspite, and there's a kind of memorial stone on the beach at Marazine. So I hope that wasn't too confusing. But there's two meetings a year, and that's why there's one in Weymouth and one in Marazine in lovely Cornwall, which we can't visit at the moment, or we won't be able to have much fun there in the pandemic. But hopefully, maybe in a year or two, we'll get to go back, you know.
Yeah, it's good to know that, you know, those kind of remembrance events are still happening.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, most of them have gone, have petered out the association. But some are strong, some still carry on, even though there's no veterans in. I mean, one of them is HMS Hood. That's an association that I know is strong, and there'll be others as well. So the memories do live on, and they are still saluted. And when a new ship comes along, of course, you know, it may be, if it's built in time, that some of the veterans that sailed in either the, well, not the World War II one, because there's going to be very few of them, but maybe in the ships that came after World War II, maybe the ships that carry the same name, some of those veterans will attend those warships associations as well one day.
Thank you for coming here to talk to me today. It's been an excellent discussion about an excellent ship.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. And it was good to keep the memory of what they call the Grand Old Lady going.